Before you hear this next story, let's offer a caution. Hitchhiking is not generally safe, but it happens to be a way of life in Moscow. That may be about to change. NPR's David Green sent this postcard from the Russian capital.
This is the way you get a ride in Moscow. You stand on a street corner like I am right now, shivering, and you stick your hand out, and you just wave down any car that will stop. Doesn't have to look like a taxi. It could just be like this guy who's pulling over right now in his old car, and we negotiate a price.
Traveling this way can be an adventure, even embarrassing. There was the time I played host to the British novelist Tom Robb Smith. He had written about Russia and wanted a true Moscow experience. I waved down one of the city's old Ladas, the boxy Soviet clunkers still trying to stay in one piece. The driver had the radio blaring as we passed Red Square, then unexpected stop.
We ran out of gas.
The first taxi I've ever had that's run out of gas.
Welcome to Moscow.
For people who live in Moscow, flagging down random cars is routine. Actual taxis are scarce. The subway can be hot and crowded. And if you throw your hand up, a driver will usually pull over within seconds and take you anywhere downtown for $5 or $6. But this may be ending. A new law to be enforced beginning in January will fine drivers for taking passengers unless their car's registered as a taxi and they install a meter. I asked one of my recent drivers, Sergei Volkov, his reaction. Sure, the government's intentions seem worthy, namely getting control of the taxi industry and making Moscow seem less like an anarchy. But like other drivers, Volkov worries the new system will be twisted to give the government another chance to extract bribes. As for passengers, the numbers are problematic. Moscow, Europe's largest city, officially has around 12 million people. The actual number is likely even higher. Yet there are only 9,000 legal taxis. Jumping in strangers' cars may be not the best solution, according to blogger Jennifer Yermeva. Here's how she described the experience in one of her columns.
I feared imminent death or severe bodily harm from either bad road conditions, criminally minded taxi drivers, or simply being trapped in a vehicle whose certificate of roadworthiness had lapsed about 2 decades, driven by someone who was more at home on either a combine harvester or a Wii console.
But the American-born writer who married a Russian and lives in Moscow still gets around this way. She doesn't do it alone at night, but during the day.
Any car at all can pull up. It doesn't have to be a taxi.
You're hitchhiking. I mean, it's basically hitchhiking.
Well, hitchhiking with money.
Do you feel safe, safer doing that here than you would in, say, New York,
I would
Washington?
Never do this in New York. It's just a part of life here.
And part of post-Soviet Russian culture. Especially in this crowded, chaotic city, there's a feeling that the government isn't there for people. Going to court with a complaint? Pointless. Police? They just want bribes. As for transportation, may as well rely on fellow citizens.
There's always been a sort of citizen-to-citizen help and assistance where the state maybe has not been as supportive. Нам нужна
садовая каретная. Ермева and I wave down a car to head to her next meeting. She was happy to pay a few dollars for a lift, and 58-year-old Sergei Pichonkin was happy for extra gas money. He needs more than his $400 a month pension. I'm a retired military doctor, he said, and here I am giving rides to American journalists. What do you think? Is this a good thing? His question hung there as we sped on. David Green, NPR News, Moscow.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. A decade ago, English writer Peter Ackroyd came out with an unusual biography, not of a person, but of a city, the City of London. That book spanned from prehistory to modern times. And in the course of his research, Ackroyd realized that a lot of what happened in London took place underground. And that's the subject of his latest book. It's called London Under, The Secret History Beneath the Streets. Peter Ackroyd spoke to us about it from our studio in London.
Almost as soon as I'd finished my study of London, I became interested in and fascinated by the history of the city which lay beneath it. It's almost as large and as complicated as the city above ground, and in fact, in some senses, the workings of the underground city determine the pattern of life on the surface above.
You talk about these layers of sediment and clay that go sort of down about 30 feet under the city of London. It's essentially city upon city upon city. I mean, all of these civilizations are kind of trapped in those layers, right?
Yes, that's correct. Within between 24 and 30 feet of material lie the remnants of all the past Londons, which date back more than 2,000 years ago. When Christopher Wren was building St. Paul's Cathedral, he discovered in his excavations a Saxon brooch. Then beneath that, he discovered a Roman object. Then beneath that, he discovered what looks like a sort of prehistoric tool. And then beneath that, sand and seashells.
Christopher Wren doing that in the 17th century, and London today is a very different city, as you describe it. We all know of the Thames, of course, the River Thames, but I was surprised to learn that there are 13 rivers and brooks in London. They are all still flowing, but they're not visible from above ground.
No, they're now underground rivers, running silent and unregarded by the populace. They have names like the Westbourne, the Tyburn, and the Fleet, the Ephra. They were once great river roads. They entered the heart of the city, and along them floated vessels of various kinds. Some of them had bridges over them. Some of them had little islands in the middle of them. But the inexorable development of the city meant that they were all, in the end, bricked over and forgotten.
Certainly the most prominent feature of London Underground is actually the subway system, which is the world's oldest, opened in 1863. You write that when it opened, Germany was not yet a country. America was still largely agrarian, and this was an incredible feat of engineering at the time.
Yes, the pioneer, the innovator, the one who inspired the building of the Underground, Charles Pearson, was actually born in the 18th century. He was born in the same week that Marie Antoinette was executed. Mm. So you can see the longevity of this scheme. When the Underground was finally finished in 1860s, it could have been used by Charles Dickens, Charles Darwin. Oscar Wilde used to use it when he commuted to work as the editor of a ladies' periodical. So it is a very old system indeed, and it still in certain respects retains some of its ancient features.
The early trains, you write, were of course steam trains, identical essentially to above-ground trains, except they were underground. And presumably it must have become very smoky inside.
Yes, it became very, what we would now describe as unhygienic, I suppose. Mm. It was full of smoke and soot and dust and coal. It was essentially like taking a steam locomotive and putting it in a confined space. So you can imagine the amount of discomfort it caused. People fainted on the platforms. It became quite common for people to have to be taken up into the air to recover. It was altogether an unpleasant experience, and many travellers described it as if they were going into the bowels of hell. It seemed so difficult to survive there.
I'm speaking with Peter Aykroyd. He is the author of the new book called London Under. There's an amazing photograph in the book. It's of people sleeping on the escalators inside of a tube station.
Yes, that was during the Second World War when thousands of people would buy a ticket at the end of the day, bring sandwiches or even beds and even deck chairs and settle down on the platforms in order to spend the night there. It was not a particularly agreeable experience because of the proximity of so many thousands of people, but they believed it to be a necessary one.
Whole government departments moved underground at the time. There was a newspaper that was made available to people underground at the time.
Yes, there were newspapers, libraries, various refreshment rooms. It was another city which grew up a time of danger.
When you walk along the streets of London now, are you constantly imagining what is beneath your feet, a series of pipes and waterways and tunnels and paths?
Yes, I think of it in certain parts of London. There's a area of London not so far from where we are now, which houses beneath the surface a huge underground city that was to be used in times of nuclear attack, for example. There were several miles of railway. There were rooms, bedrooms, studios, conference rooms, all of them just 100 feet or so beneath the surface. And that has never been used. It remains empty to this day. But whenever I walk over that part of London, I feel very strongly the presence of this space beneath me.
And it's just sealed off. Nobody goes in there.
It's sealed up and nobody goes. It was once an official secret, of course, but now it's simply deserted and abandoned.
When you write about London, and obviously you live there, do you sometimes just walk around with a notepad and just take it in?
Well, I don't walk around with a notepad as such, but I certainly walk, and it's become my habit over many years to walk at least an hour every day, every evening, in order to reacquaint myself with the atmosphere and with the setting of the city. It's always haunted me, and it's always been the place to which I return as often as I can. And I'm aware somehow of the presence of the past. The history of London is not for me some academic subject. It's a living presence, which I feel all around me. And I feel it just as strongly on the underground train as I do on the streets above.
That's Peter Aykroyd. He's written a new book about subterranean London. It's called London Under, The Secret History Beneath the Streets. Peter Aykroyd, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
There are now more than 7 billion people in the world. People in Shanghai can send instantaneous text messages to people in Sioux City. So it may be all the more remarkable that there are a few score of tribes, maybe a few thousand people, in the Amazon who've never had contact with the outside world, with so-called modern civilization. In 2002, National Geographic asked Scott Wallace, a journalist who's made many treks into forbidding places, to chronicle the trip of a 34-man team into the Amazon rainforest to search for the perimeters of a people known as the Flecheros, or the Arrow People, said to turn back all interlopers with a shower of poisoned arrows. His new book is The Unconquered, In Search of the Amazon's Last Uncontacted Tribes. Scott Wallace joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we should understand from the outset, the orders on your mission were to avoid contact with the uncontacted.
Exactly right, but it's quite a paradoxical kind of quest, because we have to approximate to get close to the Arrow People, but there's always the danger of an inadvertent contact in that situation.
And the greatest danger for the Arrow People wouldn't even be any of the guns that you were packing for a variety of reasons, but something a lot harder to detect.
Yeah, the germs, yes. The Arrow People have no immunity to the germs that we carry. Common cold, influenza, measles, these things can devastate an uncontacted Indian tribe. And as soon as you get close enough to them to try to help them, you're introducing this host of competing values and creating desires in them that they didn't have before, desires in their psyche. They begin to forget how to hunt traditionally. They want shotguns. They want shotgun shells, blankets, all sorts of stuff. Right now, as they are, they can live in the jungle completely free of the world's money economy and thrive quite well.
At the center of the story, and a compelling figure, is Sidney Pozzello, an explorer who had once been head of FUNAI, which is the National Indian Foundation. How do we begin to understand him? Because you had some divided thoughts throughout the course of the trek.
Sidney Pozzello is a remarkable character. He led a sea change in Brazilian government policy toward the isolated Indians still living in the Amazon in Brazil, to leave these last tribes alone, to actually identify where they are and to protect their lands and keep intruders out.
He's an easy man to admire, sometimes a hard man to like.
That's correct. So he was the one leading our expedition. And he had a remarkable rapport with the Indians, with the natives in our expedition, but was something of a tyrant when it came to dealing with his fellow white men.
Some of the adventure in the story is the adventure, just the challenge of getting there.
Okay, so it began with 2 weeks of travel by river up a tributary of the Amazon. Then we left the boats behind, the boats turned back, and we began bushwhacking, hacking open virgin jungle, our whole column following single file the lead scouts as they were breaking open the jungle with machetes. And that was 3 weeks of doing that bushwhacking.
You didn't want to contact the Arrow people because you worried about it could have a disastrous effect on them. But you also had to live in fear of the Arrow people if, in fact, they noticed you first, right?
That's very true, because they are known as tenacious defenders of their land. And in the past, people who have tried to enter their territory have been repelled with poison-tipped arrows. And there was no way they could understand our presence in their land as anything other than a hostile intrusion. Although we would leave a gift here and there, cooking pots, machetes, axe heads, those kinds of things. And we would leave those gifts from time to time to demonstrate our peaceful intentions.
If the whole idea is to let the Arrow people alone, why not just let them be?
Well, this is closed canopy jungle. And you cannot tell, for example, if they are facing imminent threats from outsiders, from hunters, loggers, poachers, if you do not mount this kind of expedition.
You kind of wait through the book for a moment of contact. And there is not that moment because, in part, you're trying to avoid it. But how did you know you were in their realm?
The first sign that we had, we came upon an abandoned camp where they had left leaves on the ground, and you could see the indentation of bodies that had slept there. Then we began to get really close and found footprints that were really fresh.
I understand the morality of no contact, but let me ask you about another morality. I mean, life, modern life is more than just lethal germs, isn't it? Would some contact with the Arrow people give them access to knowledge that could improve their lives, help them live longer, help them be happier? And would that be so terrible?
I think undoubtedly that some of that, what you say, is true. The question is, what price would that contact involve? Pozuelo said himself that even in the best of circumstances, when they had teams of doctors and nurses and transport to help this was the Arara tribe back in the 80s. They had all these things in place to help these people once they made contact with them. But what happened was the people started getting sick, and they fled into the jungle and infected other people. And so even when you have the best of intentions, it doesn't mean things are going to work out the way you would like them to work out.
Scott Wallace's new book is The Unconquered, In Search of the Amazon's Last Uncontacted Tribes. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We turn now to another oral history project. Today is the National Day of Listening, the annual event when the folks at StoryCorps ask people from around the country to interview the people who matter most to them. This year, we're hoping you might pay tribute to a teacher. Tell Me More Barbershop contributor Lester Spence has this story for the project. After high school, he was accepted into the University of Michigan, but the notion of attending a prestigious school was bittersweet. Riddled with self-doubt, Spence recalled his first time on campus and how he desperately wanted to show he belonged there.
You know, I hoped to God that I would fit, because it was just wonderful going from a place where I felt that nobody understood me and then coming to a place where only a couple of people knew me. And what that meant was that I could basically kind of recreate myself. I could start from scratch.
Lester's self-doubt came after years of his teachers in Detroit schools telling him he wasn't good enough to attend college. But that all changed when he met Professor Ralph Story. He encouraged Spence to show his natural intellect in his English class.
Do you remember Inger by any chance? Inger?
Her name sounds familiar.
Yeah,
Inger Lovett.
Yes.
Was that her last name?
Yes.
I do remember her. Yes.
Yes.
And as I recall, you guys got into a kind of debate or exchange that was very heated.
Oh, my God. We would get into these running battles, yeah. right? I mean, he's running.
Sort of gender battles.
yeah, whether it's black male, right. female relationships or
right.
race versus class. I mean, we were getting to these heated arguments, right? And that was the first, in fact, that was the first space we had those discussions in. The whole idea of black male female relationships being like a space for political discussion, or better yet, being something, a subject that was worth writing about, that my experience was worth writing about, as opposed to something I'd had to leave outside of the classroom. I mean, that was really empowering. Now, could you talk to me about how you are, I mean, so it's one thing to use a Socratic method, but it's right. another thing to use it with very specific issues that spoke to those kids in that classroom.
Okay. What happened is that when I first came to Michigan for graduate school in the late 70s, by the early 1980s, the whole notion of gender and gender battles and male-female relationships was constantly in the popular media, and in particular, it was in the African-American media like Essence and Ebony. But what really intrigued me was Robert Staples was a guest lecturer at the Center for Afro-American and African Studies. And he would hold these forums, and the forums would be packed with over 100 people.
Yeah.
And so it seemed that he had carved out a kind of ideological and philosophical space within the teaching of sociology to address this topic, almost like Harry Edwards did with the sociology of sports. And so I assumed that this would be an excellent subject for my students to write about because it was close to home. And it was essentially argumentative.
So imagine this, and maybe for some of the listeners, it won't be hard for them to imagine, but there's this whole population who probably would get it. The closest I had come as a student to being able to deal with those issues in the classroom, or issues even remotely related to black people, right, was when I tried to write an essay about Prince in my English class in high school. And my English teacher was like, no, you cannot. I don't want to read about this guy. You can't choose him as a topic. It's the idea that I couldn't, in a way, I had to leave my blackness. I had to leave all that stuff at home and could never deal with that in a classroom setting, right? So when you talk about being able to go to a college, not just a college, go to Michigan, one of the best universities in the nation, right? And all of a sudden, somebody tells you, like, you can write about this. My mind was literally blown. And that was the first time anybody had ever talked to me in that way, that they had identified what I felt was inside me, but I just didn't know for sure was really there.
I'm very proud of you, Les.
Thank you very much. That really means, that means a great deal to me, man.
You're more than welcome.
That was Professor Ralph Story and Professor Lester Spence telling their story for StoryCorps' National Day of Listening. We're hoping you might thank a teacher today on Twitter with hashtag ThankAteacher or on the StoryCorps' Facebook page.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The NPR series Hard Times is on the road this month, visiting places and people feeling the pinch in this tough economy. For many charities and nonprofits and the people they help, hard times are getting harder. NPR's Sam Sanders visited a group called Free Arts of Arizona and has this report.
It's a clear, mild fall night in Phoenix. In a domestic violence shelter on the west side of town, Mario Barella is teaching children of abused women how to drum.
Okay, you guys ready? I start, you guys follow.
Most of the 20 or so children in the class come from families in distress. One parent, usually their mother, is fleeing an abusive partner. Most of these families are poor. I was allowed to sit in on the drum class, called Buckets of Fun, but I can't name or share the location of the unmarked shelter. I also can't disclose the names of any of the children here. There are kids outside the class who are too young to participate, peering through the windows of the small shelter cafeteria. A very pregnant program manager from Free Arts sits on the sidelines, tapping her baby bump to the rhythm. Her name is Jennifer Flowers. She says that arts therapy like this can work wonders for abused children.
It's awesome. I think the joy that these kids get to experience in this 1 hour with Mario is unparalleled by anything else that they get to do.
And for children dealing with serious problems in their families, Flowers says banging on paint buckets is one of the better ways to cope.
Because kids that have been through trauma so often turn to those negative things like drinking and drugs and self-mutilation. This is such a great way to be able to get those emotions out in a healthy, positive situation.
But for all the good these classes do, programs like Borella's are in danger. Like nonprofits all over America, Free Arts has been in a financial crunch for some time now.
We have lost half of our government funding. We've lost just about a third of our staff.
Barbara Finster is the executive director of Free Arts of Arizona. Besides layoffs and budget cuts, Finster says Free Arts had to stop hiring artists. And now, when businesses want to send volunteers to Free Arts, the nonprofit doesn't just say, come on down. They require a cash donation from those businesses as well. Even though people continue to give to Free Arts, the poor economy keeps donations down.
When they last year gave us at $500, this year they're giving us $400. Or a foundation that gave us $10,000 is giving us $7,500.
That, matched with cuts in government contracts and less support from philanthropic groups, can hurt.
You add the loss of 5% in government funding and the loss of 2% in foundation funding and the loss of, you know, whatever it is, the loss of 10% of individual giving, and now you're starting to talk about a significant decrease in your bottom line.
But Free Arts says they aren't giving up. They've matched cuts in staff and funding with increases in volunteers, many who are laid off and seeking new ways to fill their time. As the class winds down, none of these issues are on the kids' minds. They just want to know if Mario Borella will be back next week.
Are we going to do this every single Monday?
Borella says he will. The program isn't just for the kids. It helps him, too.
I mean, me, myself, a musician, business owner, artist, they're helping me to express and share my art form, and I mean, I'm able to get funds through them, you know, and it, which I mean, puts food on my table. I appreciate that.
At the end of the class, Borella takes out a big plastic trash can. He's teaching the kids how to improvise. He keeps the beat. They make up their own over his. Free Arts is doing the same, improvising new methods of survival to keep the art they give alive. For Borella, it's worth it.
Like their slogan says, art heals, man, I believe it.
Sam Sanders, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Once every 2 years, the orbits of Earth and Mars are aligned just right so it's possible to send a spacecraft from here to there. That special celestial time is now. And this weekend, NASA's Mars Science Laboratory is scheduled to lift off from Cape Canaveral for an 8.5-month journey to our solar system neighbor. NPR's Joe Palca has this preview of the mission.
NASA has some experience with rovers. In 2004, the Mars exploration rovers known as Spirit and Opportunity began their missions on Mars. Astonishingly, Opportunity is still going nearly 8 years later. But those rovers are puny compared with the Mars Science Laboratory.
The Mars exploration rovers landed, basically crash-landed softly with airbags. Mars Science Laboratory is so large that we need an active propulsion system.
That's John Grotzinger, project scientist for MSL, as the mission is known. The day I interviewed him in 2010, we were standing on a balcony above a large clean room at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, where the rover was being put together. The six wheels had just been added to the boxy frame. This rover weighs nearly 2,000 pounds. It's about the size of a small compact car. That active propulsion system that Grotzinger mentioned is a pretty wild scheme. It's a sort of a rocket-powered helicopter. when it gets to about 200 feet above the surface, it lowers the rover down on a cable. With the rover dangling below, it descends slowly until the rover wheels touch the ground. If you get a chance, check out the animation of the landing on our website, npr.org. Like I say, it's wild.
The risks are obvious, but the advantages of this are that the rover lands basically intact, and there's almost no subsequent setup that has to be done after the rover lands.
The rover has a mast with a camera on it and a robotic arm, but Grotzinger says MSL is not just about taking pictures and pulverizing rock.
It is a laboratory, and so within the belly of the rover are two very important instruments. One of them is an X-ray diffractometer, which is the instrument that geologists use on Earth to characterize the mineral content of rocks and soils.
The other instrument is called the Sample Analysis at Mars, or SAM for short.
So this is an upside-down SAM.
Back in 2008, I visited NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. As you can see, I've been tracking this mission for a while. On this particular day, some of Sam's guts had been removed. What I could see was a box about the size of a microwave oven. Various pipes and cables were sticking out. Paul Mahaffey is the chief scientist for Sam.
This big cover you see here is where the 74 cups of Sam and the sample manipulation system go.
Mahaffey explained that pulverized rock from the robotic arm will be deposited into one of the cups.
It gets pushed up into an oven. We heat it up in the oven to 1,000 degrees, and as the gases are coming off, we measure their composition with a mass spectrometer.
One of the elements Sam will be able to measure is carbon. Carbon is essential for life. But Mahaffey and everyone else associated with this mission says finding carbon compounds will not be proof that there is or was life on Mars. It will just be another piece of evidence pointing in that direction.
We fully don't expect we're going to go to Mars and get a definitive answer, yes, there was life, or no, there wasn't life, unless we happened absolutely to hit a home run and land in exactly the right spot and conditions were exactly right.
If everything had gone according to plan, Sam and the rest of MSL would already be on Mars. The mission was supposed to launch in 2009, but delays in building hardware forced a 2-year postponement. When I spoke with Mahaffey last week, he sounded relieved that Sam was about to leave Earth.
We've been anxiously awaiting the launch for a long time, and even more anxiously awaiting August 6 of 2012 when we land in Gale Crater and start exploring.
Gale Crater is MSL's target. It's a giant crater with an enormous mountain in the middle of it. There's lots of interesting geology and maybe more evidence that Mars was once habitable. Joe Palca, NPR News.